This talk was given by Danica Shoan-Ankeli at the Zen Center of New York City. Shoan is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Shoan, and my pronouns are she, her. I wanted to speak this morning about practice in the forest of brambles. And the forest of brambles is a phrase that kind of speaks for itself, I think, but it's used in Zen literature to refer to the entanglements of our life, the complications, the thorns that catch and tear and hurt. Perhaps the very thing that we came to spiritual practice hoping to avoid, the teachings instead ask us to turn around and head right into that bramble patch. There's a poem by Otagaki Rengetsu, who's one of the women ancestors whose name we chant in the female list of ancestors. And it's a poem that was introduced to me by Hojin Sensei, and many of you are familiar with it from Wild Grasses Session. It goes, rather than cutting them down to spread out or gather up, let the wild grasses of autumn be. I want to enjoy the field just as it is. Those wild grasses, again, is a Zen metaphor or teaching for the delusions that spring up in our life. And so I think many of us, I certainly count myself among them, come to a practice like Zen hoping that we will cut down, gather up, and burn the wild grasses in a big bonfire and be done with them once and for all. And if we stick around and practice long enough, we're going to come to one of two conclusions. Either we're doing it wrong, or it doesn't work that way. And we're not doing it wrong, which is why it's helpful to have a sangha and people to talk to and teachers, so you can check yourself and be like, am I doing this wrong, or is this the nature of life? And I cannot tell you how many times that very question has been in some way, shape, or form a question that I have brought to my teacher, Shugen Roshi. An exchange is coming to mind, fresh in the moment, that I can't fully remember, but oh, I know what it was. It was basically relatively recently, me going into Dokusan. So Dokusan is private interview with the teacher, one-on-one, and saying something along the lines of, like, I'm still grappling with XYZ, you know, some delusive tendency of mine. And him saying, what made you think that would change? So we may want spiritual practice to solve the problems, quote, solve the problems in our lives, to make what feels difficult feel easy, or to clean up the mess we feel like we've made of our lives, or just to smooth out the wrinkles, to help our lives really conform to our ideals, to make our fantasy reality. But that is the fantasy. Okay, that's not actual spiritual practice. Instead, these teachings are pointing us to learning how to embrace the complexity of our life. And embrace doesn't just mean like hold it close. It means like don't be separate, don't hold a thing outside. And so much of Zazen practice is learning, how do we do that actually with our mind? How do we not be separate? When we discover that, when we taste it, when we begin to deepen and develop our capacity to do that, we see there is so much power there. It is transformative. I was thinking about that forest of brambles and, you know, that field of wild grasses and wanting to go in and clear cut. You know, and if you think about a space that has been clear cut, it's desolate. It's painful to even witness. So why would we want that for our life? Instead, we learn how to befriend the brambles, how to appreciate their vitality, their ingeniousness, all the life that they contain, and to learn how to work with them. So we're not, you know, constricted or bound up in them, but we're not denying, pretending they're not there. Instead, we get close enough and work with ourself and our mind and heart and body enough that we can find the pathway through. Learning how to be at home in that forest. So the forest of brambles is not separate from our spiritual life. They're not two things. And when we chant, this morning we chanted it together, the teaching, the identity of relative and absolute, or the harmony of sameness and difference. We are touching in on that exact teaching. The sacred and the mundane, that's an arbitrary, or not arbitrary, but a false duality. Within light, there is darkness. So this is from the words we chanted earlier, from the identity of relative and absolute. Within light, there is darkness, but do not try to understand that darkness. Within darkness, there is light, but do not look for that light. Light and darkness are a pair, like the foot before and the foot behind in walking. Each thing has its own intrinsic value and is related to everything else in function and position. Ordinary life fits the absolute as a box and its lid. The absolute works together with the relative like two arrows meeting in midair. Water is on the way. Thank you. When I get nervous, my mouth dries out. So I'm a little nervous. What can I say? Thank you. This is going to be so good. The relative and the absolute, these are kind of stiff words, I feel like, actually, for the great mystery that they point to. But we use them, so it's good to understand what they mean. So the absolute, also within that identity of relative and absolute, referred to as the darkness, is the place where there is no differentiation. So that is the oneness, the fundamental, the great emptiness, our true nature, one thing. All beings have one essence. absolute darkness. That's what that's talking about. Those are concepts, and the absolute will never be touched or reached in any way through concepts. But for the purposes of having a conversation, we need to trot out the concepts and make use of them. Then there's the relative, which is the light. Darkness within darkness, there is light. Within light, there is darkness. So these two things are like two arrows meeting in midair, completely one reality. And lightness, you can kind of infer, is the other side. So it's the relative world, it's the phenomenal world, it's the world of differences, of multiplicity, of many beings, of forms and shapes and colors, of all of our attributes. Ordinary life fits the absolute as a box and its lid. The absolute works together with the relative, like two arrows meeting in midair. Which means that each and every thing, each and every person, each and every moment is this meeting of two arrows. But mostly we don't see it that way. So we each are a manifestation of this absolute, this fundamental oneness, and all of our embodied differences, attributes, characteristics. And our lives are shaped so much in obvious ways, in ways that we see every day by our differences, by our gender, by our race, by our preferences, by our circumstances. All of those pieces make us who we are. And to some degree, sometimes more than we can possibly know, are really shaping our experience. And that fundamental unity, that oneness is there all the time. It is shaping our life too. When we turn toward the Dharma or feel ourselves looking and searching, that's that fundamental oneness in you. That's your light Buddha nature arising, manifesting. And when we feel connected or solidarity with a person we don't even know, that's that oneness. When we feel stepping out into an autumn morning, just how it pierces through our heart, that's that oneness manifesting. So spiritual life is about learning how, to some degree, the absolute and the relative, our oneness and our multiplicity, actually work together, and how to use that reality to help each other, help ourselves, be in harmony, take care of things. And so we may want just the radiant light, rainbow body aspect of our life, but it doesn't work that way. And the messy, uncomfortable stuff is sacred too. It has a lot to teach. So when we sit down in Zazen, we bring all of that to the cushion, which is so amazing. We were speaking the other night, a group of us, about the spiritual path, and a couple people offered up that when they first came in to this Zendo, actually, and were totally new to Zen practice, and sat themselves down and heard the bell ring to start the period, they thought, oh, shit. Because there it is. It's just you on the cushion, and you're like half an hour of me sitting here just on my own. There's no like pulling out my phone and checking my messages or whatever people do. And there's no preparation in a sense. There's no purification ritual. We don't, leave our baggage at the door and then come take our seat. It all comes to the cushion with us. And isn't that our experience of Zazen? That in one moment we can feel the spacious, awake, connected, vital Buddha nature glancing by our heart, And in the next moment, we're obsessing, we're clinging, we're, you know, planning a terrible act, whatever it may be. It's all here. It's all here. So we're not cutting anything out. We're not cutting anything down. How do we proceed? First, we have to bring our whole self into our practice, onto the cushion, our whole self. So we have to start to see, is there something that we want to leave out? Is there some aspect of ourself that we don't like, that we're rejecting? Is there some way that we don't feel at peace with who we are? And it's not that we need to make peace with that before we can start practice. That's not how it works. But it's good to see that, to begin to see that. And if we feel like we've gotten the message, like that's not okay, that's not allowed in here, then we need to re-teach ourselves the truer message that it is okay and it is allowed in here. I first, perhaps most poignantly, came across a teaching on bringing your whole self to the cushion, reading the book, The Way of Tenderness, by Reverend Zenju Earthlin Manuel Sensei. And she is a Zen preacher, Zen priest and teacher, and a Black woman and lesbian, and came to the Dharma. And in her book, she writes really beautifully and very powerfully about the experience of having to see how to bring her whole self, all that she had been given messages about through her life that was not right and not good. And it was only when she realized that needs to be here on my cushion, that's Buddha, that she was able to really open up to reality. And of course, she's also speaking from the context of hearing these teachings on the relative and the absolute, where sometimes naturally, I think, or maybe not naturally, but understandably, Zen students can prefer the absolute. Like, we're here, we know about the relative, we think. We know about our differences, and we want to find oneness. That's where the goods are. That's where the peace is, right? And so that gets emphasized, and we can think like, oh, okay, all that other stuff, it's just thoughts, it's just conditioning, it's just structure. I just need to get over it. And it's not like that at all, in fact. So we have to be ourselves completely, bring it all into the room. And that fact can be extremely disappointing, to have to be our whole self. If really what we think we want is to cut some of it out and leave it by the highway. Trungpa Rinpoche writes, we expect the teachings to solve all our problems. We expect to be provided with a magical means to deal with our depressions, our aggressions, our sexual hang-ups. But to our surprise, we begin to realize that this is not going to happen. It is very disappointing to realize that we must work on ourselves and our suffering rather than depend upon a savior or the magical power of yogic techniques. It is disappointing to realize that we have to give up our expectations rather than build on the basis of our preconceptions. And I would say that this disappointment, in a sense, unfurls all the way through our practice. But the funny thing is that there's another side to the disappointment. So the disappointment is acknowledging, oh, it's not like how I thought. It's not going to be how I wanted it to be. And then the other side is releasing, allowing the spaciousness of reality. Seeing how our expectations and thoughts and ideas have actually been binding us. how by letting go, we can actually take in what's already here. And what's already here is those two arrows. It's already perfect and complete. So in this way, our disappointment can actually become a signal. We don't have to feel disappointed by our disappointment. We can think, oh, disappointment is arising. Disappointment is arising. That must mean I have an expectation. I wanted things to be a certain way, and it's not working out that way. Let me look more closely. The Forest of Brambles has a million teachings. Every burr that gets stuck on our clothing is an invitation to, like, come closer, to look, to see. So I've been thinking about how strong feelings are like emotional flares that the truth sends up. They are like signals calling our attention. They are manifesting in our relative world, but they are a sign from the realm of oneness. And so for me this week, my emotional flare was anger. I don't know how many of you watched or heard about the Kavanaugh hearings. And I didn't watch them, but I was following it and watched, you know, excerpts. And I felt, as many people felt, anger arising in me. And so I have been asking myself, you know, as a practitioner does, like, okay, so what is this showing me about the Dharma? And there are many teachings, actually, on anger within Buddhism. And often they are teachings about transforming anger and how anger is actually identified as one of the three poisons. And in my state of anger, I felt like those teachings don't feel quite right. I'm not ready to transform this. Transform it into what? And I discovered an offering by a Buddhist scholar who wrote about how anger and aggression, that actually often the poisonous form of anger is really aggression, and that in many cases in the Buddhist teachings, aggression would be a better word choice for translation than anger. And that anger actually has a very raw, clear, pure energy to it when it originally arises. It can, not always, but it can. And aggression has a self-centered, belligerent, combative, unskillful energy associated with it. And perhaps you can feel in yourself anger versus aggression. Aggression is often directed, right, to someone. Anger can be also. But somehow there's a subtlety there. And that it's that subtlety that has seemed extremely important to me, taking in the place that our country is and has been lately with Me Too and women's anger coming out. When I take on the investigation of anger as a pure energy, and this applies, you know, beyond my frustration at the Kavanaugh hearings and more widely in my life, when I really see, you know, is there a way in which anger manifests as a sacred energy, as a signal from the realm of truth? Something is not right, right? There's been a disruption. That feels quite correct, actually, to my own experience. And within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there is a whole pantheon of wrathful deities. And these are Dharma protectors, spirit protectors of the truth, right, of the Dharma, who manifest in a wrathful form, flames, skulls, drinking blood out of skull cups, like really like pretty raw, serpents twined around their bodies. So this is a, to me, I felt like, oh, this is kind of a confirmation. There is something here. This wrathful energy, this clean, clear, raw anger energy, its energetic quality as it arises is extremely powerful. It's extremely powerful. And what is the power? What is the power of anger? The power of anger is that it's arising from truth, from reality. And that reality is oneness. That reality is love. When that is breached, it is natural and correct for anger to arise. And indeed, if we look at social justice movements, there's always anger in the beginning. That's a correct response to injustice. But that anger needs to be worked with, right? If we freeze ourselves in the anger, it feels terrible, and it's also not so effective. You know, if you think about the angry activist, you know, that is not, if I'm just drawing on like Dr. King and Gandhi and all of these people who were clearly touched, right? Clearly motivated initially from seeing injustice and what I can only imagine was a raw, clear, fierce anger arising. But then working with that, seeing like that, that's a signal. That's not the end. It's a signal. Anger can be used to illuminate truth. And once we've received the message and digested it, and we can't rush that process, that anger needs to be transformed into action. All that energy needs to be transformed into action. There is such a power in expressing and being heard and being received. Tarana Burke, who is the founder, actually years ago, of the Me Too movement, a Black woman who was herself a survivor of sexual assault, recognized that being seen, recognized, and heard and corroborated in your experience, validated, was extremely powerful in a healing process. It was powerful because it was empowering. It gave a voice where a voice had been taken away. And so the Me Too movement has been this kind of unfolding, ongoing, like giving a voice where a voice was not heard initially. It's interesting, some of you who are my generation, I read this really interesting article about the movie 16 Candles by John Hughes. I don't know if anybody out there knows this film. I grew up on it and I loved it. And this was looking back and saying like, oh wow, that movie really was about like date rape. Like, whoa, I didn't even realize that. So our culture is changing. It's changing, which is fantastic and painful. Both things. At our last week at the monastery, we hosted the Soto Zen Buddhist Association conference, which is a conference that takes place every couple of years. It's Western ordained priests and Dharma teachers that gather. And as an ordained monastic, I had the opportunity to attend parts of the conference also. And one evening we did, it was just on the agenda as like a Me Too panel. And I was like, what's that? And I didn't know if I really wanted to go. And somebody was like, no, you should come. So I showed up. And what it was, we divided into two groups, those who identified as men, those who identified as women. And we, the women were in, basically, it's called the practice of counsel, which is kind of like a sharing circle with a talking stone, and people, it's totally confidential, and people are invited to just speak their truth into that circle. And someone, there are people kind of holding the space, and someone introduced, the theme that we're taking up tonight is Me Too, however you want to take that up. And so I'm sitting in this room. It's evening. The residents are doing zazen. And I'm sitting in the multi-purpose room at the monastery in a giant circle of chairs. I think there must have been 30 women in that room, ordained Zen teachers and priests. And women began to share. And the talking stone was passed around the circle twice. And it was devastating. It was so brutal. And it was so powerful. It was so amazing. It was like both of those things. It was both of those things. And at the end, and you know, nothing happened in one sense. It's just people speaking their truth, their experience. And being heard and held and validated and corroborated by others who know. From that experience and so many other experiences that I've been having, also around our Beyond Fear of Differences work, there's a group of us, a mixed race group that's been meeting to talk about our order, the Mountains and Rivers Order, and how white supremacist culture functions here, and what we need to do to address that, transform it. Through these conversations, I am learning in such a deep way how important it is to talk about these things, you know, and all of the different configurations that that conversation needs to take, women with women, men with men, people of color with people of color, white folks with white folks, women and men, people of color and white folks, all of these different ways. There's a power there that is not predictable. It's like going into the relative realm of all that difference, all that multiplicity, and then trusting so deeply in the oneness that you're going to hang in there even when it gets super uncomfortable, terrible. And when you hang in there through that discomfort, it's just the same thing in some ways as in zazen when we're overtaken by an extremely uncomfortable feeling state. And we hang in there. We don't check out. We don't freeze up. We stay with our experience. That is the oneness having a chance to hold us. Sometimes we need to be the ones to speak. And sometimes we need to be the ones to listen. And we need to find our way in that. And we're going to screw up. But hang in there. That is spiritual practice. That is realization, manifesting. That is the relative world and the oneness, two arrows meeting in midair. Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams says, there is no liberation without collective liberation. And so any idea that I may have had, or that any of us may have, that we can like come and take care of our zazen and like do our little practice and realize the way and, you know, head out enlightened, like, sorry, disappointment. It's not going to happen that way. You can have insight, sure, but real freedom, real liberation, it is completely bound up. It is completely bound up. This week, one of the wonderful white guys in the Sangha said, you know, I feel like I belong to a tribe of murderers and rapists. And in that moment, I took that in and felt, ah, and have thought about, oh, there's a conversation there that I could be part of. We don't have to solve it. You know, I felt like, oh, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. But we don't have to know what to say, right? There's a conversation there that can happen. That's the same conversation. And that conversation could happen with a white guy and a white guy, and they can help each other take care. And that conversation can happen with a white guy and a white woman, a woman of color, and it's going to be a different conversation. And there better be some listening going on from the white guy. And we don't know. If we open up the space to have that conversation, we don't know what will happen. That's the truth. Reverend Angel also says, she said this in a talk she gave, that we have to have this conversation and raise this conversation to a level where it will not go away. So I don't know what's going to happen with Brett Kavanaugh and the Supreme Court. You know, if it happens the way I want it to happen, I suppose, yes, I'll feel like I dodged a bullet. But the real matter isn't about that. The real matter is that there is something happening here now in our culture that is extremely important. And that is the speaking truth. And all the anger that's arising, those are signals, those are flares from a realm that knows something is wrong and that truth needs to have space to be heard. And all of that anger, those of us that feel it, we need to be very, very mindful. We need to be mindful of using it, experiencing the clear, raw energy of it, and letting that move us into activity. There is a truth that is beyond words. And there is also a need to speak, to express, to be heard. And this is also our spiritual practice, not separate. So those brambles, rather than cutting them down to spread out or gather up, to let the wild grasses of autumn be, what does it mean to enjoy the field just as it is? I don't fully know. In this time and place and moment, I don't know. But I can feel an aliveness that's coursing through all of this. And that's what I'm paying attention to.
Thanks so much for listening. Please join us on October 6th at the Zen Center of New York City for Our Lineage of Spiritual Friends, a day-long retreat with Mark Finn. For details or to find out more about ZCNYC programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC.